Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the work group of the High Tech Annual Report. We have our full team with us today, Carolyn Peterson and Aaron Murray as co-chairs, and Christina Caraballo and Brett Oliver as members. We have the meeting agenda up in front of you, and I will turn it over to our co-chairs to get us started.
Great. Thanks, everyone. It's great to see you all on our second meeting in September. Looks like we're making some really good progress, and I'm excited about what we're going to take up today.
Same here. Let's get right into it and appreciate everybody joining today. Let's have a little fun with this. Okay. Kaylin, you want to kick this off?
Sure. So
all right,
here's our schedule. Pretty familiar to all of us by now. After today, we've got a meeting in mid-October and mid-November and mid-December, and then we will present the draft and hopefully get approval early in 2021. Next slide. And then these are the dates of the high-tech meetings where we will be bringing things forward for their review and discussion. Next slide. So our steps starting today will be to review the draft crosswalk of topics and then to present an update on the draft crosswalk of topics in October at the high-tech meeting. Next slide, please. So let's dive into it. Next slide, please. There you go. We had thought we would start from the top again and go through because there have been some changes and just figured it was good to kind of reconnect with the whole thing instead of just the parts that we've been working on. Are we able to make that a little bit wider or are we limited by the tool? Okay. Yeah.
I think Katie, is that it? Are we not able to widen that? Or should we just instruct people to use full screen?
We can. It just depends if you want to zoom in more or not.
Or we could use binoculars. I will open my copy of this so that
That's right. Exactly what I was doing. Yeah.
And I think, Katie, just for the
easy.
Or for the public view, if we can, for those that are listening, if you can, you can enlarge to full screen in the upper right-hand corner. It looks like a little square box there next to the three dots. It is a little hard to read otherwise.
Okay.
A lot of good information. So.
That's right. It's not a quick read, even when you have a full-size copy. So starting on the first page, additional target area. This is the public health target area that we've been talking about adding. And the first topic, exchange of clinical data for public health purposes. We've got a gap and a challenge, our opportunities. And then a third recommended activity that we've added. That would be facilitate acceleration of the practical use of data standards to improve situational awareness for local, state, and federal government emergency response. That is in addition to hold a hearing to understand stopgap solutions, to improve reporting capabilities, and assess whether long-term solutions are needed, and then suggest HHS guidance on minimum necessary data sets for exchange for public health. So it's kind of expanding upon the theoretical ideas that we already had listed on the grid. Thoughts?
For me, I think we talked about this a little before. I like the standards concept there. I think it's important. I think it expands upon the need that there may be gaps there, particularly with public health, which I think we all know that there are. So to me, it's a worthwhile add. So I think we imply it. I don't think we ever called it out like this before, so this makes sense.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that's a key concept that maybe was missing.
Yep, I agree. I like this addition.
Good. Yeah, I agree that it kind of, it's sort of the obvious elephant in the room that was there but wasn't called out. So now it's very specific. Do we have any other thoughts for that one, that topic?
No, I like this. I think the other dynamics would get into it a little later on. But this is good.
Okay. Let's head to the next one, privacy and security for public health purposes. And here we had an existing gap and challenge and an opportunity to discuss the trade-offs between increasing interoperability, protecting privacy and security, and ensuring public safety during pandemics. We have a new opportunity, increase the clarity about the privacy and security concerns associated with biosurveillance activities. So this kind of extends it a little further and adds more specificity about what the privacy and security concerns are. And particularly also things that are not necessarily privacy and security concerns about other kinds of information.
That's right. To me, I like it because it really brings a level of transparency, which is the whole point of this thing, which will raise the public trust with these efforts for public health purposes, right? The more you're transparent and the more we can bring awareness to any gaps, the more, I mean, at least the thought is, the more that the public will participate in various, you know, activities to keep people safe. So to me, this is another dimension of it. I think it's important.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think it's kind of like the elephant in the room. It's one of those things that if we don't address it, then people's fears will get in the way of us actually making progress.
Bingo. Okay.
All right. And then the proposed recommended high-tech activities remain the same. I think we've talked about those quite a bit in the past, so I won't dive into it again. The next landscape analysis topic is vaccine tracking. And here we have the gap. We have a challenge now that is more clearly stated. Large populations require advanced technology to create models using large data sets and to identify individuals or groups at higher risk of disease, but such resources and expertise are limited. And the opportunity, more developed, is to investigate whether predictive analytics is or could be used to aggregate and analyze this data to anticipate needs for vaccines among vulnerable and or high-risk populations, including for flu and COVID-19 prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And
the only thing I would add to this, and I think it goes with the challenge as well, but definitely with the vulnerable and high-risk populations, there's a lot of scrutiny occurring now with these large data sets related to making sure that there's a level playing field. So the health equity component of these data sets and making sure that it's representative of the entire base of people, and so that your models aren't inadvertently excluding types of demographics or various individuals. So I would just say something around equitable, you know, creating equitable models or equitable data sets, something to that effect, so that people know that we are aware that there are large models out there. And I think we've seen this, one of the big bugaboos with machine learning is that some of the data sets inadvertently exclude types of, you know, race, gender, sex, whatever, that affect the outcome. And so I would just say equitable, because this is also coming up now with vaccine tracking.
Can we say models that promote health equity?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just thinking, I don't know that there are any models today that we would say are truly equitable or that we even know exactly how to develop such models. But certainly pointing up that we're heading for equity would be doable today.
I like that addition. And scrolling through this, we might also include just education and awareness for patients as well.
Good point.
That's a good one. That's a really good one. Like, educate people on the importance of these vaccines. In an equitable manner, right? So if you're Spanish speaking, you get it in Spanish or whatever. Okay.
And then the proposed recommended high-tech activity is to hold a listening session to identify opportunities and barriers for healthcare and public health organizations and highlight successful vaccine program interventions using predictive analytics.
I still agree with that. I need to know more, right? I mean, we're just now here in Austin looking at this and starting to dig into it, and it's there's a whole lot out there, and a whole lot you just kind of scratch your head. So there's a lot more to learn.
Do you have any thoughts, Brett?
Yeah, I'm trying to collate them here. Yeah, I definitely think we need to understand more. Part of it. When we say predictive analytics, that's where I'm struggling. I don't know what that means. Are we talking about machine learning, AI? Yes, all of the above. Because I think another piece to this, when y'all are talking about equity, we're also talking about liability too. And I don't think what we're talking about here would, you know, we're just trying to find potential risk populations to identify them so we can, you know, reach out whatever the clinical scenario might be. With AI, there's this liability piece that is still up in the air. And I just, when you guys read investigate whether predictive analytics, what are you reading into that term predictive analytics?
To me, it's exactly what you said the first one was. So it's not AI, it's identifying at-risk cohorts and potential clusters of at high at-risk populations or people who could become at-risk, right? Example, we're right now doing a big study across the city to see just with our 1 month of data with the kids being back, students being back at UT, what is the infection rate and positivity rate? And the data is telling us that even though we have a high percentage of we're seeing infection rate on campus, those students, are not mixing with the population as much as we thought we were, so it's not adding to the general positivity rate across the city. So we're keeping track, almost like a virtual geofencing of students that we're contact tracing, to make sure that we maintain that positivity rate from, you know, really jumping out of the norm here in Austin. So to me, the same thing with vaccines, right? You would look at and say, okay, where are the predispositions for people that need vaccines first, especially once you identify what those different tiers are of who gets vaccinated first, and then try to educate and partner with. That's how I read this.
And I'm
thinking that makes sense.
There might also be a functional component in that if you could understanding where the vaccinations are occurring and where they are not, that might help you work with, for example, hospitals and health systems, schools, long-term care facilities, in terms of identifying where outbreaks might crop up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you know that a particular area is lower in vaccination rate than in other parts of the country, say where you've got some kind of medium degree of outbreak, then you could potentially say that's an area where they should be really watching. And well, I don't know how you would do penetration testing exactly with the technology we have today, but it would be a place for schools and care facilities to be really on the lookout, because in the community you have a risk of greater infection rate and more escalated rates than others.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer people that are vaccinated.
Yeah,
exactly.
I agree. And then once you, if you can identify where immunization rates may be low, then back to what Christina was saying with education, there may be different ways of reaching different populations. And rather than blanketing everyone with every form of communication, which is probably not feasible, to know, okay, in this population, if we could send out, you know, emails, or if the TV ad or whatever it is, we know we have a better shot at at reaching that group to get the vaccine. So yeah,
that's right.
Thank you for your patience there. I want to make sure.
No, it's a great question. I mean, I'll give you an example. Some of the at-risk populations here in the state of Texas, what we have found is that sometimes the best way to reach them is actually partnering with like the Red Cross or a local church or the YMCA. And it tends to be points of a congregation for these individuals that they're more trusting of something coming from, say, the YMCA than it would be a official leader. So it just is also those mechanisms which allows us to go, you know, work with a trusted third party on, you know, for public health purposes to make sure there's a vaccination program. So that's how I read this.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
go ahead, Carolyn.
I was just thinking, if you can probably use social media and Google searches to identify areas where there is greater interest in anti-vaccine information, which would inform your decision about what areas you really wanted to look at in terms of vaccination rates and potential for outbreaks. You know, if you know particular neighborhoods or zip codes, there's a higher proportion. They've been able to make estimates and assumptions about flu based on Google searches, for example. If you know this is an area where there's a particular interest in anti-vaccine websites and literature and more activity on Twitter and other social media, you could interpret that as a place where you'd want to be really watching and maybe doing more testing or other activities.
That's exactly right.
I agree with that. I'm wondering if after predictive analytics, we add a little bit of guiding text, then maybe something like predictive analytics to better target outreach, education, and response efforts and strategies, or something along those lines.
I like that. So more specificity on what predictive analytics means, kind of explaining the why and a little bit of the what.
Exactly.
Yeah, I like that.
Cool. On this next page, page 2, the next topic is patient matching for public health purposes. We had our gap, and we have the challenge more fully described. That would be missing demographic data can delay patient outreach and complicate contact tracing efforts. And I think that should be contact tracing rather than contract tracing. Our opportunity remains the same, and we've expanded the proposed HITACH activity a bit to develop tactical recommendations based on ONC's forthcoming patient matching report to Congress, including consideration of expanded use of AI and related privacy and security concerns. So do we need to add any expansion to that based on the discussion about the previous topic, as well as anything else?
I think I'm just trying to think in my head how... I mean, I think we could. I like Christina's approach, which is to kind of break it down a little bit and talk a little bit more about, again, the why and some of the what. To me, the why is, again, we are this allows for, you know, again, I'm not a wordsmith here, but, you know, accuracy of identifying, you know, at-risk populations and then, you know, advanced algorithms or this augmented intelligence that will help, you know, determine where those potential risk points are, and identifying people accurately, you know, so that I know that Aaron really is at risk and we're going to get in front of Aaron. But to the point of making sure that Aaron also understands it is for his own well-being and that he can opt out and all kinds of things that need to be done around privacy and then, of course, the security of that data. Somehow, I guess, expanding on the why, right? Again, using Christina's rubric from earlier, which I really like.
So if you're Aaron, if you're doing patient matching, say for COVID, for instance, are you, if the lab has CCDA information, are you allowed that information from a privacy and security standpoint?
For public health purposes, you're allowed elements of it, and then it's different between what's allowed under FERPA versus what's allowed under HIPAA. And there gets to be some murky grounds there. How you can share that. Now, from a public health authority perspective, I think the public health authorities can definitely, from a public health emergency perspective, they have, I know OCR has done a great job of clarifying exactly what those data elements are, but when in doubt, as I've learned, as we're doing contact tracing, we just get explicit consent. Like we explicitly ask before we get any elements from anybody on what we're doing. And it takes longer, but it does build trust. So to the point of trying to automate some of that with, again, artificial intelligence or augmented intelligence, again, it's all about how do you maintain that level of trust and transparency, but you're informing and teaching the patient or the at-risk population as appropriate.
Because it's been a clinical issue since I've been practicing, the data coming from labs not having, you know, you get a lab result on someone in the middle of the night that's critical, but the lab has no contact information, nothing. Now, it's been made a little bit easier with integrated EHRs and being able to look people up in your system that way, but it's a continuing problem. And I was just curious with contact tracing. You know, I know with HIV, there's almost kind of an open book on what you can share with the public health officials, but I didn't know with like vaccine or I'm sorry, COVID tracking and things like that. You know, if it was just a mandate that the CCDA, just that alone, that had the demographic information would be enough. I don't know if it's
one of the biggest challenges we've had was that, exactly that, is tying the various EHR data back to the case reporting, right, and the lab reporting. And again, not having a unique patient identifier or a strategy around that to make sure that Aaron is uniquely identified in each of those. I mean, we've had people that go to Walgreens and CVS for testing, and they come into UT Health Austin for testing, and then they show up for PAT testing 3 weeks later for elective surgery, and you're like, holy smokes, how many times have you been tested in like 2 months? But yet you wouldn't know that unless somehow in the systems are all linked and there's no master patient index. So you end up having people that have been tested for COVID multiple times. Not that it's a bad thing. It's just a waste of resources and time and effort.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think the recommendation needs to stand with the additional caveat to the AI piece that you all talked about, Christina recommended.
Yep. Okay.
All righty. If we have no other thoughts about that one, we'll hit the last topic in this area, and that is international exchange of clinical data for public health purposes. So here we have our gap and our challenge, and the opportunity we've added is to share and apply lessons learned across many countries about the use of health IT to support public health, for example, for electronic case reporting. And the proposed high-tech activity is to hold a listening session to identify opportunities and barriers for the use of health IT in international exchange, as well as lessons learned that can be applied domestically. And some suggested panelists could be the CDC, the WHO, clinician representatives, and privacy and security experts. So here we're kind of filling out some of the discussion that we've had in the past with the opportunity and a possible activity.
I think this looks great. I think that we should definitely, in the proposed recommendations, add the Department of Commerce on here. They have a really strong health IT group. Actually just talked to them last week about USCDI and kind of how we're looking at international data standards in general. So I think that would be of interest to that group. They also mentioned to me the Global Digital Health Partnership, which would be another one to note on the group of experts that we should potentially reach out to.
Great suggestions.
Okay. Sounds like we're pretty much comfortable with what we have with this one. So why don't we head to page 3, and I will let Aaron take the lead on the next target area.
Cool. All right, interop. So the item here was the exchanging of health data more broadly across the care continuum. Our gap here was interoperability needs to be increased across the broader care continuum. The challenge, of course, like long-term post-acute care, behavioral health, home-based services, whatnot, are limited in their ability to exchange data with other clinicians, including social determinants of health, in part due to EHR design. So the opportunity there is a collection of more complete data about a patient, which will help clinicians identify risk factors or procedures, offer interventions, and provide targeted care. And some of the additions here that we added are in the red text there. And so, of course, one of our proposals was to learn more about the recent developments in the area of PROs. And then, 2, identify and help improve data streams where interoperability is a challenge to sharing broader data sets, especially when a pandemic affects healthcare settings like long-term post-care, acute care, and any transitions to and from those settings. And so I think what the point was here was to expand upon that. What we would do is not just say, hey, this is broken, but offer solutions, and then focus really on what we're realizing to be sort of that care transitions that end up being where some of those gaps are when patients go across the medium. And then they go to a long-term rehab, and you're like, what happened to them? Did Aaron, like, recover? Did he go home? Like, what happened? Those issues are missing, again, and I think we know that in broad context, too, beyond just the pandemic. Thoughts, questions, concerns?
Yeah, I'd like to understand a little bit further with the ADT notification requirements upcoming, how that's going to affect this gap, at least for the long-term care facilities. Just knowing that they're there or they've left is a humongous step forward. Just concerned about how that all fit in. I feel like there's different levels of this data. There's something as simple as an ADT notification, and then something that could be, maybe it's simple but more complex to me, like a social determinant of health or notes from a nursing home, which, you know, if they're still on a Tandy 2000 with a daisy wheel printer or they're on paper, I don't know what kind of technology options we'll have.
Yeah, that's a good point. Outside the pandemic, let me give you an example. So we implemented patient-reported outcomes across most of our subspecialty and ambulatory line, whether it's, GAD, PHQ, 2-9, common PROs, whatever, who's coos for ortho, we've implemented all of them. Those results, both pre-admission and during and then post, after, and then we do follow-ups, all those data values actually are stored as critical lab values in the patient's chart so that physicians can go back and look at those and say, hey, is Aaron trending up or down on who's coos or whatever, right? And you can trend that, you can document it. In order to share that information across the other health systems so that it would go there, I literally have to send it as a critical lab value. Otherwise, there's no easy way to share PROs, right? They're just not built in natively to the system. So when you look at Commonwell now and you pull Aaron's record from, UTL Boston, say, XYZ Hospital that's on Commonwell, it'll come across. PROs will come across, but it's going to come across as a lab value because there's no easy way to do that. That's just a real-world example of some of the gaps that exist here. And so how do you do that when you're transitioning care settings when it was designed for that?
Yeah, great point, Aaron.
Another recommendation that we could add that would build on work that was done in the Interoperability Standards Priority Task Force is more work around closed-loop referrals. I've been working on some areas in social determinants of health and following Gravity Project very closely, and one of the things that's been identified is just the lack of standards around referrals in general, which the IST task force did identify. But then also what we're often discussing right now is referrals from provider to provider, so specialty referrals. And we're still not looking at standards-based referrals as much as I think we need to more the community-based organizations. So I think that would be a really helpful area to start looking at as well. I'm happy to expand on that more if that didn't make sense.
Could you for me, maybe I'm just not, maybe my brain just froze. I'm not 100% understanding.
I'm in the earlier stages of figuring this out myself, but as we're trying to incorporate the use of social determinants of health data into the care continuum and work with things like people, groups like community-based organizations, it's been identified that there is a lack of standards-based referral processes. And the ISP task force put this as a high priority, just standards-based referrals in general, like their top three as a gap during our last session. And I was reading through their recommendations as I was trying to figure out what standards-based referrals would look like in with community-based organizations as well, and realized that it was very provider-to-provider focused, which is fine. They don't exist. That's a great place to start. But what I found is that groups are starting to look at, that are looking at social determinants of health and expanding more broadly across the care continuum about how to implement referrals. So it would be really helpful if we start now and start guiding the industry and these organizations to have a standards-based approach for referrals as well.
I get what you're saying. So I'm going to give you a real-world example. I think I understand what you're talking about. So let's take contact tracing as an example. One of the things that we've realized, and I think it's been published already here at UT Austin, is that as we are contact tracing with the city and finding contacts, we are finding people also that have discrepancies or deficiencies in their environment and in their home. They're in a food desert. They may not have a utilities. They may not have a job. There's other issues affecting them. And so suddenly our contact tracers now become care navigators and help connect them to like Meals on Wheels and other social services available or whatever else, which is exactly what you're talking about, is using SDOH data to set up informed referrals based upon other criteria other than just, you know, your physical condition. If now you're in a food desert and need access to food or clean water or whatever, right? You need shelter, all those components. So that makes complete sense to me. So how does SDOH, the point of the care continuum, how does this inform, data-driven referrals or data-driven SDOH referrals? And I'm not a wordsmith, but I totally, hopefully my example makes sense to Michelle, who will put it into English for us.
I will try.
I totally get it. Yeah, Christine, I get it. Thank you for explaining it to me. Once you did that, the scenario popped in my head. Brett, does that make sense to you as a physician? Yeah, does that make sense to you, Brett, as a physician?
It does. Yeah, I'm following you.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Let's go to the next one then. So we don't have anything to change on the next item. It's still all in the black text. But please look it over. Just in the terms of time, though, I'm going to skip it and go to the next item so that we focus on the colored text items, because that's what we really want to address. But do take time in your off time to go look at these that have stayed the same and, you know, address anything that comes up. So we're going to go to that third bullet now, exchange of SDOH data. So the gap there is that business models across healthcare do not yet support the capture and use of SDOH data. Yep, standards and data availability. Patient matching at varying levels of technical maturity, like I just told you about my example of PROs. If SDOH data is collected, they are usually documented as free text in the EHR. That's right. That's why I did discrete lab values, limiting the ability for data exchange across clinicians and community service providers. So the opportunity is to develop and adopt standards for SDOH data collection, transfer, and integration for pop health and individuals' needs. And then, of course, our recommended activities, one of them staying the same, which is suggest updates on SDOH for the ONC playbook and patient engagement. And then two, convene a group of stakeholders in the community SDOH tech companies, community-based organizations, standard development projects, to understand the state of SDOH data exchange and practice, identify gaps and barriers. The only other thing I would add to the stakeholders is add the payers. We've had really great engagement from the large payers about using SDOH data and funding those kinds of programs, because I believe it's well documented that the preventative care and, you know, helping people out in the food desert and getting them food will help, you know, mitigate other comorbidities that could become a lot more costly and thus have a detriment to social determinants. So I think payers would be the other group I would add to this blue text, but that's my comments. What do you all think?
Yeah, that makes sense.
I agree.
Yeah, I like the addition of payers.
Okay, good. All righty.
And I really like our second suggestion on here, and I like how we added the actual understanding the state of SDOH data exchange and practice and identify gaps and barriers. I think that's a key piece. So nice addition.
Yeah, and we can use examples like I just gave, you know, my shop. What we had to do is to share PROs, right? We had to make them a critical lab value because otherwise you can't share it easily. It's totally bonkers. So, you know, things like that I think would help give coloring as you convene these group of stakeholders. All right, increasing health equity across populations, locations, situations. All right, so data is not systematically, collected nor used to identify disparities in outcomes, healthcare, and risk. Lack of standards, so the gap there, or the challenges, lack of required adoption and use of standards for collection and storage of relevant data can make it difficult to identify at-risk populations and to implement appropriate interventions. Again, lack of interoperability makes it difficult to exchange the data. We talked about that earlier. Opportunity there is advanced requirements to collect and share data about groups experiencing health inequities. The data can be used to support the implementation of culturally, linguistically appropriate health IT solutions. Of course, again, fill in the black text there, identify non-traditional sources of health information that can be made interoperable. The proposed recommended high-tech activities, one convenient group of stakeholders, again, we need to understand how to improve collection and sharing of data that can support identifying and addressing disparities in healthcare. To the current state of potential improvements of the accessibility of consumer-facing health IT diverse populations. And then three, non-traditional sources of health information that could be made interoperable to better serve at-risk populations. All right, so I can give you a real-world example. Austin, Texas has a large Latinx community. We know that Latinx community has a disproportionately high share of infection rate with COVID-19. We've had to modify a lot of our approaches, whether it's education, whether it's engagement, whether it's tooling, whatever, to make sure that those at-risk populations, in our case, the Latinx community and others, are appropriately engaged and feel safe to engage. It kind of goes along the themes earlier of health equity. And this is about leveling the playing field to make sure that wherever your locale, whatever the population you're engaging with, wherever you are, that you're able to reach them in the way that they want to be reached, and they feel safe and comfortable, and they understand it. That's my make it simple example. Thoughts, questions?
I like it.
Do we feel like we're missing anything when it comes to equity? Do we feel like we're missing anything? Or do we feel that health equity is generally understood, that most people will read that and go, okay, I understand what that is. I mean, I do, and you all do, because we love this stuff in a really interesting way. So, but with the general public, and will people understand what health equity means? Or do we need to define it?
Never hurts to define it. I think B there will help us define it a little bit further in terms of understanding current state. But yeah, I don't think it hurts to define what we mean by health equity within the context here.
Okay. Carolyn, Christina, you guys good?
Yep, that's good to me.
Yep.
Okay, all right. Move on then. Sharing data with the research community, obviously near and dear to my heart here at UT. The gap is researchers are challenged by data quality and consistency concerns, limited governance, policies, inconsistent implementations across technical architecture, and a varying needs of individuals and organizations that create and use data. So the challenge require, and this is in the blue text here, require a health IT infrastructure that supports the use of electronic health data for research and sharing of data among clinicians and researchers. The opportunity there is to increase alignment between clinical and research ecosystems to enable research to happen more quickly and effectively. And to me, I would simply add both research and prospective research, which are uniquely different when you look at it from an academic perspective, because one may be a new prophylactic that you want to deploy, but you don't really know, and you're going to try to source that out and work with a place to make that happen and figure out what data you need. And the other one may be like clinical quality improvement kind of research, where you have already a program in place and you're like, how do I lower my rate of infections of CLABSIs in this unit a little bit faster, right? So I would just say maybe we need to define research a little bit and say this is both prospective and ongoing as two definitions. And then from a proposed recommended high-tech activity to hold listening sessions to learn more about the gaps and standards needed by research, which is accountable to institutional review boards, and then identify educational approaches that increase awareness and promote the implementation of national health IT priorities for research and a policy and development agenda. And I think both of those are needed. What do you all think?
I really like what you said about research, because I think traditionally, if I read this, it would have been somebody doing an official study. It's gone through a review board or whatever. But the fact of the matter is so much more of it is done prior to that, where you're trying to understand either as an organization, as an office, as a payer, where are your gaps, doing your own internal research. And if you don't have that data, you can't find that. I think I might have a gap here. You look at it and you're like, no, I don't. I think I might want to study this. And then as you do some sort of pre-research, as you term, you realize, nah, that's not going to be worth our while. And having that data is just as important as the data you need for an official research trial.
Bingo. That's exactly right. Either on mute or I dropped.
No,
okay.
No,
I'm still with you. All right, let's move on. All right, this is a metadata subtopic, again, around research data sharing. In this case, the gap is many data management tasks are burdensome because they require manual human labor for reconciliation. This kind of goes back to what you were just saying, Brett. The challenge there is the lack of common metadata and nomenclature in use. Even I would say data provenance and other issues that occur with data. The opportunity there is to determine the types of metadata and related standards necessary to facilitate machine-based clinical data management, including management of exchange data to reconcile data from multiple sources. And then the proposed recommended high-tech is to charge a task force to review and provide recommendations regarding metadata standards and potential additions to USCBI. I will go give an example. This, and Brett, you'll probably remember this fondly. If you recall, in the early days of DICOM standards and in the early days of image standards, it seemed like every single vendor had their own proprietary standard that they would save the respective image on, so that if you had a vendor X fetal monitoring image, it could not be opened up with some generic viewer. You had to have that specific viewer, so that emergency rooms were then having to burn CDs with that viewer application literally like executable on the CD with the image, so that people at another site could actually read the image. And it was impossible, right? Everybody had their own proprietary stuff. And it was like, how do you read this? What's going on? And how do you exchange data? It was nearly impossible until people figured out how to do a DICOM wrapper and make a universal viewer work. Again, Brett, I'm sure you remember those days fondly, right? So
Absolutely. It's one of those things that it is still an issue in the research community because of these varying data sets and the nature of research to try to push the envelope and obviously generate new bodies of knowledge, that you still have that issue. Maybe not with images, but you have that issue in general with data sets. Like, how do you actually use this thing? How do you actually work with it? And then when you're looking at giant data, like you know, 10 million records, you know, the project we're working on right now related to COVID-19, just to normalize that is a Herculean effort because there's not a common nomenclature for metadata and tagging and a data dictionary that doesn't look up. So that's just an example of some of the issues and gaps that exist. And, you know, thinking about this, it became very big, very wide, but it's very important how to standardize those types of things. Thoughts, questions?
No, I agree with what you said.
I like how you got it worded.
And what do you think? Because I know you have a lot of dovetails with the USCDI.
I don't really have anything to say.
All right. Carolyn, are you good with this section?
Sure.
All right.
Privacy and security. Okay. So the first analysis topic. Are we able to fix the feedback?
Yeah, we're working on that echo now.
Okay. The first topic is beyond HIPAA protections for data generated outside of the HIPAA framework, and it's a rules for sharing subtopic with this one. So the gap was the lack of clear rules for data not subject to HIPAA protections. The challenge was that for third-party access to health data, there are implications of private sector partnerships between apps and payers, like Google and the Accenture partnership. So the opportunity we've come up with is to increase transparency and patient education for business practices and other potential uses of patient health data when healthcare organizations share or learn.
Apologies, Carolyn, if I could just jump in. If we could ask the task force members to mute your phone or computer, if you have both on, I think that's where the feedback is coming from. Thank you. Sorry, Carolyn.
That's okay. So I'll read that opportunity again. To increase transparency and patient education for business practices and other potential uses of patient health data when healthcare organizations share or license data to technology companies. And for the proposed recommended high-tech activities, there's three. To hold the listening sessions to learn more about HHS and FTC activities. Second, to explore patient and clinician experiences with the sharing of health data with third-party technology companies to continue to identify best practices and gaps. And third, to review government and industry activities that are already underway protecting the privacy and security of health data shared with third-party tech companies. So here we know what the gap is and the challenge. We've known that forever. But these are more specifics about the opportunity and some possible activities.
Yeah, I can tell you that this is again heating up in the industry in terms of topics. And in fact, I had a few discussions today with some national folks about this kind of stuff, with a lot of folks, I think, that don't understand the nature of third-party agreements, business associates, and what do you do with data generated outside of HIPAA? Like, what do you do with that? Right? That doesn't fall under HIPAA. And I'll give you an example. So for someone that sends their data to a genetic testing service consumer-wise, like a 23andMe, that is not subject to HIPAA or disclosure or breach notifications or any of those kinds of stuff. And FTC has limited jurisdiction in its current ability. So there's these gaps that you would have thought that these things qualify for, but HIPAA was written at a time where those companies didn't exist, right? Those business models didn't exist, so it wasn't thought of. So that's kind of that's what this is about, in my opinion.
I think recurring in all sorts of discussions across the high tech over the last three years. I think the question is how do we feel about that?
I think it's important. To me, I would like to know more, and I know there's a lot of work going on. I know that based upon my various levels of engagement with various folks. I think it'd behoove us to learn more and figure out other things, specific activities that we can do to help educate and pave the way so that we can, as an industry, get our arms around this.
Yeah, I agree with understanding. The need to learn more.
In the discussions, it might be helpful to include some of these third-party apps as well.
Yeah, if we have an example or two, we can add just in parentheses, like EG, you know, whatever, that would kind of help point people in the direction we're heading.
Yeah, I mean, I like that, but when we're looking at activities that are like focused on exploring the patient and clinician experience, reviewing government and industry activities, but we're talking about third-party apps that don't explicitly put them in as a stakeholder group that we should be reaching out to as well. So when we hold the listening session, that's a group that we should also learn from and listen to. So engaging third-party apps.
That's fair. That'd be interesting. I don't know how you would, I guess you would just put out a general call to anybody who does healthcare apps or third-party kind of things. I mean, that I'm aware of, there's not like an EHRA for third-party apps.
Yeah, I don't know.
Again, we got to learn. I don't know. Okay.
Maybe the consumer electronic group could help us.
Is that helpful, Michelle?
It's hard to hear sometimes.
So
I'll try again.
Are you all ready to go on to the next one, or do we have more to bring up on this first topic?
I think we're good. We're good.
Okay. So for the second one, this topic is beyond HIPAA. Protections for data generated outside of the HIPAA framework, and here the subtopic is consent. So the gap was the lack of clarity about the parameters of data sharing and disclosure and their implications for consent. The challenge is the rules for consent have not been established for receivers of received data when they get it. The opportunity is the further improve clarity around patient consent for research and exchange of data. And then we're adding two topics to proposed recommended activities. First, to identify educational approaches and potential regulatory solutions that offer improved transparency of privacy protections outside the purview of HIPAA, and second, to explore ways that clinicians can educate patients about the benefits and potential risks of using third-party apps as contemplated by the ONC Cures Act final rule, and about the need to review and comprehend apps privacy policies. So this gets at the patient ed point that Christina has often brought up and that I sometimes do as well.
I think the patient ed piece is critical. People need to understand what in the world these apps, what kind of, I'm sorry, this echo is driving me nuts. I don't know.
Sorry
end.
About that.
I've got,
sorry about
I'm that. I'm muted and I'm way on my phone.
Yeah, we'll ask the others, just Erin, Carolyn, Christina, if you can mute as well. Meanwhile, we'll keep troubleshooting on our end. Okay, it should be clear now. Can we try again, Brett?
Sure. I was just saying, I think this is critical. You know, a patient sees an app, and if it's, you know, in an app store, all of a sudden there's some credibility to it. Even within the Epic EHR app orchard, if it's in the app orchard, it must be clinically accurate. And I think patients need to understand both the clinical utility and accuracy of things and what kind of scrutiny an app's undergone, as well as the privacy and security concerns.
That's a really good point.
Yep, I agree. Okay. Any other
thoughts? I've returned.
Oh. We just talked about our agreement for that second one on the subtopic. Do you have any additional thoughts?
Mm-mm. No, I liked it.
Okay. We'll go on to the third topic then. This one, protections for data generated outside of the HIPAA framework, the Internet of Things subtopic. The gap is that there is limited interoperability across IoT vendors. As IoT objects become more integrated with health IT systems, security risks increase. Additional concerns have been raised regarding the challenges of informed consent for users of IoT technologies. So we've added a challenge and opportunity and proposed recommended activities. The challenge is there is a lack of understanding of the privacy and security vulnerabilities of using devices connected to the Internet of Things. The opportunity is to increase awareness of the privacy and security risks of using the IoT. And the two recommended HITECH activities are, first, to identify best practices for increasing the privacy and security of connected devices. And second, to identify educational approaches that increase awareness of the privacy and security issues related to the Internet of Things and ways to reduce them. So still kind of an emphasis on awareness, but not specifically patient ed via the provider.
I would absolutely agree. I mean, this is a major issue, especially as more consumer devices become medical certified with the FDA, you know, fast-tracking a lot of things, which is great. There's a lot of standards and a lot of variety of technical devices now in the wild that are now coming into the healthcare continuum. And so I think we do need to put some guidance out there and we need to learn some more about what's going on and bring awareness, because it's not a bad thing. We just need to just be ahead of it.
Christina?
Nothing to add. Thanks.
Same.
Okay. We'll head to the last topic under this priority target area, privacy and security of synthetic data. So the gap was HIPAA constraints limit the ability to conduct research and train machine learning models using large-scale data sets in both research and healthcare settings. The challenge was to determine the unique privacy and security considerations driven by the emergence of synthetic data, such as using AI to re-identify de-identified data. And then today we're adding an opportunity and a proposed activity. The opportunity is explore whether the use of synthetic health data raises privacy and security issues, and if so, to what extent. And the proposed activity would be to hold listening sessions to determine whether the use of synthetic data raises any unintended privacy risks, such as the ability to use AI to re-identify the actual patients on which the synthetic health data is based.
So to me, this is important, right? And I think this ties back into especially the research realm that we talked about earlier and all the things around health equity and all kinds of concepts. And so to me, these large piles of synthetic data, if they are not de-identified and or stripped and or really have any identifiers removed and all sorts of things, you could reconstitute the data, as well as if the data set is missing gaps of, again, race, color, sex, whatever, types of individuals, it could be leading to health inequity as well.
Yeah, I agree with you, Aaron. I think I'd like to propose the recommended activity from my perspective. We need to understand more and what are those unintended risks.
Did you have any other thoughts, Christina?
No, I don't have anything else to add on this one. Looks good.
Okay. So we are done with the privacy and security priority target area. Do you want to grab the last one, Aaron?
Sure, last two. All right, so this is a priority target area, patient access to information. The topic is the patient-controlled data collection, access, and sharing. The gap is the safety of mobile health applications. The challenge is safety and effectiveness concerns with consumer-facing mobile health applications. Here's the opportunity to provide reliable information about the quality of apps to enable clinicians to advise patients about which app to use and to empower patients when using apps to make decisions about their own care. So what are we proposing as activities? One, to support the existing efforts of a consortia that are working to vet apps based on their safety and accessibility and educate patients about the findings of the consortia. And then two, explore ways the safety of mobile health applications could be enhanced. This goes back to, again, the examples I used earlier with, you know, people walking in with third-party apps or whatever else, and the issues there, what covers them, what doesn't cover them. What, you know, right now it's putting clinicians like Brett in the firing line to have to explain to patients when they have questions, and half the time they don't. Right, we get phone calls all the time in our call center from patients, you know, asking just general questions, right? And so it's just there's this gap when it comes to mobile health applications. And that is a bad thing. We just need to understand it, scope it, size it, and address it.
I agree. I think that you put that really well. And I think this is becoming increasingly more important, especially as we see more and more efforts around access and app ecosystems and other things that we've heard out of the federal government, both from CMS and ONC and others.
Yeah, I agree as well. I think as we see more information sharing, there's going to be more opportunity for apps to be developed, and this is really key.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if we, for proposed activities, if we might also investigate whether frameworks for assessing apps or a scorecard of sorts have been previously developed, and if that is something that the HITECH would want to look at enhancing or promoting or raising awareness about. I have the sort of vague sense that I've seen, not an ethical framework, but that there has been some work about assessing apps and what to think about and, you know, kind of questions to ask yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If we could identify something like that, I mean, if it's out there, that could really speed and facilitate this notion of helping clinicians help patients with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's fair to say clinicians have a lot of other things to do, and somebody somewhere is going to have to develop something to help them with that. They're not going to just go do it themselves. Maybe this is sort of like, you know, the 2021 version of the patient playbook that ONC did some time back. Maybe within all this whole framework of landscape analysis tasks, there's a number of things here that can be done to get at this whole issue of patient education and helping all the parties understand the issues and better make better choices.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, that's great. I don't know if that exists, Carolyn, but if it doesn't, that's great.
The Care Alliance has done a lot of work around this.
Yeah, maybe it's just promoting that, right, and getting that out there and maybe codifying
mm-hmm.
it. Okay. I'm good with that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, let's move on to the last one then. So then the topic is here, correction of incorrect data and the ramifications of exchange of incorrect data. The gap is today there is a limited ability to correct the data that's already been exchanged. And as a result, this incorrect data may persist and be further disseminated. So transparency about the accuracy of patient data and consent to share it are lacking for patients, which in turn affects patient safety. The challenge: errors need to be fixed upstream in the process of data collection and sharing while addressing concerns about clinician liability and health equity for patients. So the opportunity is to increase clarity on the applicable statutes and liability that apply to the exchange of incorrect data. So two proposed HITECH activities would be holding a listening session to, number one, identify approaches that clinicians and HIEs are taking to correct incorrect data, and two, discuss liability considerations related to exchanging incorrect data. And then I would say a third one, based on some discussions I was on earlier today, would be about third-party access to data and making changes after the fact, aka a finalized medical record. And now you have someone challenging who made this modification and why is it said like this, and having a look at the audit trail and all kinds of stuff. So it would be interesting to see what third-party access to data and how that intersects here with correcting data and the liability around that. Because if Brett finalizes a medical record and a note, and then somebody after the fact comes back and modifies that thing from the same medical group, well, how does that translate to the patient? If they're like, this is wrong, are they going to go after Brett or what? So there's a lot of little question marks there.
Yeah, I would agree, Aaron. Does it need to say discuss liability considerations relating to exchanging incorrect data and correcting incorrect data? We're talking exchanging, that's fine, but are we also going to look at what's the responsibility of a clinician or organization to change that or communicate the change?
the wording there just is talking about the exchange of it. It's mm-hmm. a liability if you exchange incorrect data. Do you have any liability to correct incorrect data once you recognize that it's incorrect?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think we should have that as an item on here because it's both. But there are state, it varies state to state, right? Like what those criteria are, who could make the modification, you know, is it just the provider that gave direct care? Could it be, you know, someone of the same health system, all that kind of stuff? The
right.
pediatric.
It's probably going to vary by the data set.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many little quirks and variations to it, which is why I have the utmost respect for HIM professionals because they keep it all straight, and I can't. But there's so many variations to it.
I think it would be beneficial to add in the proposed recommendations section a line on data provenance as well.
Hmm.
That was in a yeah.
And it's important, and I think it will be more important as patients gain the ability to add additional notations or register notes in the record that statements are incorrect. I'm aware that there's concerns about letting patients change information, but because there continues to be inaccuracies, and sometimes inaccuracies are propagated forward again and again, it seems like there's going to need to be some way for patients to be able to put in a notation that, hey, I'm not taking this drug, or, you know, I didn't have an abortion in 2007, that was a different Carolyn Peterson, or I don't have mental health issues, or whatever it is, you know, that's
mm-hmm.
accurate.
Mm-hmm.
That too would be something that will wind up in the record at some point, and it'll be important to talk about the access to be able to do that, and also the way that is there and available to clinicians and how they can engage with it.
That's a good point. So what is that mechanism for patient, I'm going to use the word grievance, it's not the right word, but, you know, for patient's dispute or dispute, patient's dispute was in the medical record and change it. And that, everywhere I've ever been on the provider side, is varied, right? The rules are varied. Of course, patients can do that, but some of them have to put it in writing, have to request, the clinician that saw them has to do it on their behalf, has to agree with their change. I mean, all kinds of stuff, right? It's a lot of hoops to jump through for a finalized note, finalized record to change that. Because it is a legal record, right? So I don't know what the liability is and how that works, you know, each state to state. It's just, there's so much to learn, but I think it's a great point, Carolyn. What is that? Right? How hard is that for patients and to qualify and quantify that in general?
Yeah, because, you know, as EHRs are used for more and more years, more errors are going to accumulate, and at some point, patients are going to be harmed by those inaccuracies. So even though right now there is resistance to some of the opportunity for patients to rectify things, you know, going forward, that will be recognized as an important point.
Yeah, I see it as a subset of chart correction, you know, whether it's a lab that was in error or it was a diagnosis that the clinician entered in error or is in disagreement. It can go both ways. I've had open notes for a few years now, and I haven't had too many conversations, but I've had patients question a diagnosis, like, I don't have an anxiety disorder, and you got that down, I want that removed. I'm like, Mr. Johnson, that's what the Paxil's for, and the occasional Valium. That's, oh, okay, I understand. You know, they're always good conversations one way or the other, but I just kind of see it as a subset of data correction, kind of the same thing we're talking about with this, but just making sure we include the patient portion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the biggest,
each organization has different chart correction policies. You know how it,
that's right.
How it can happen.
That's right. That's right. And so many times there are a lot of medical bodies that are concerned about open notes because they are concerned about their liability for the way that some of this, like Brett said, you know, you don't have depression, but this is what the clinical diagnosis came back as, and it is depression. Sorry, whether you think it is or not, having that debate makes people awkward. But if you're able to have a very structured conversation and it's a normal, again, grievance or change process or whatever that's standardized for folks to adopt a framework of some sort, that would allow organizations to be able to start figuring out how you safely have these conversations with people and thus level health equity for folks.
Yeah, there's that, and there's kind of what is the intersection of that with systems that rely upon that information, like workers' comp systems, where there's a desire for verification, like qualifying for disability and SSI. The issues
mm-hmm.
around people trying to qualify and wanting the medical records to say something or not say something or change the diagnosis because there's some other stuff going on.
Right.
It's partly chart correction, but it can be driven by a lot of other things that bring in other issues.
It could, as well as medical malpractice or, you know, not that I'm aware of anybody directly, but assume that there's some bad organization out there is like, let me modify this record after the fact without the patient knowing. And the patient goes back and is like, what is this? You know, things like that. Those are all big, big no-nos, which I'm sure have happened. I don't know if anybody does it, but I'm sure it has happened. So the patient should have the ability to be able to go back and address those, right, in a normal, addressable manner, whether it's a framework, whether it's a grievance process, something.
We would hope, yeah.
Okay. Any more questions about that? That's the last item.
Do we want to talk about the tiering? If you look in the notes in the very, in the even small, well, I guess it's not really smaller print, it's just small print. Or else I have old eyes. In fiscal year 19, the immediate action, that was one tier, that was 2020 to 2021, and the longer-term tier was 2022 to 2025 and beyond. We're proposing for fiscal year 20 that immediate would be 21 to 22, and longer-term would be 23 to 26 and beyond. At some point, we need to go through and assign a tier to each of these topic areas. They're all TBD right now. We could think about it and do that at the next meeting, if that will still occur before the full HITAC meeting. Or we'll probably
do that.
Tight on time to do it today because we've got public
yeah.
comments still.
Yep.
So anyway, the two questions are you good with the proposed fiscal year 20 tiers, moving everything forward a year and keeping the immediate term as 2 years and the longer term is beyond that? And then what are the tiers that we want to put on each of these topics?
Yes, yeah, thumbs up.
That sounds good.
Are there any other thoughts around the crosswalk or anything else that should be addressed that we didn't get to?
I think it's spot on. I like this crosswalk this year. It's really coming together.
Yeah, well, we have enough momentum behind us that we have a really good foundation for it. Part of why it really resonated this year. Okay, well, why don't we go to the public comment slide? And I see in the public comment chat there is instructions and a link, and I'll pass the mic off to Lauren.
Great, thanks, Carolyn. We'll ask the operator to open the public line.
If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you. And do we have any comments in the queue?
There are no comments at this time.
Okay, Carolyn and Aaron, I'll let you know if any others come in.
Okay. Well, the only thing I can think of is that we have a meeting coming up in a couple of weeks, and we should probably plan on doing some of the tiering work at that time. We can look at the previous annual report to see where things sat before and if we think they should be advanced or dropped back. What other thoughts do you have, Michelle, about what you'll need from us next?
I think we're in good shape on the crosswalk, and we can talk offline about how we want to proceed to gather any further input on it from the work group and how we want to present it to the HITAC on the 21st. Other than that, I think I have what I need.
Any thoughts, Aaron?
No, I'm good. I appreciate everybody's discussion today. That was fun. It was engaging, and on to the next one.
All right. Do we have any public comments?
There are no public comments at this time.
Okay, great. With that, I think we can adjourn. And thanks again for your time today.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.